Rupert, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Jake. It's great to be here.
It's my pleasure. My first port of call is a shout out to Brisket for putting us in touch a week or so ago. So Brisket, you're an absolute legend. Thank you for your help. I really appreciate it when audience members help connect me to new people to learn from. And that's what the next hour is going to be. Rupert, we're going to start off with a simple question. And forgive me if it is that simple, but what is permaculture?
Oh, that's a good question. Cool. Yeah, it's a portmanteau, pretty much, of permanent agriculture, which really, when we talk about agriculture being the food systems that underpin a society or civilization, and the food is very much connected to culture. So it has been shortened to permaculture. What are the permanent aspects of culture that continue to transcend through space and time? And, how can we integrate those into our daily lives? It was initially founded by two Aussie guys in the 70s. You can imagine 70s, we've just gotten off the gold standard. Inflation's running rife. The climate narrative is beginning, the globalization, we're running out of resources. We need to limit our consumption, da 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 da. And these two dudes, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, we're just experimenting with systems to how to grow their own food and design energy efficient housing and organize community and all of that, right, from the ground up. And so as they were looking to develop this, they extracted a lot of wisdom and a lot of knowledge out of indigenous cultures all over the world, right? And they were just identifying those patterns. What are those patterns and those aspects of culture that transcend space and time and culture? And what's the commonality?
Cool. And it's obviously a massive topic because it's, how do we survive? It's at the very core of it. And culture is, this is one of the fortunate things when, if you're like myself, you've had the fortune of traveling. Travel's the best part about travel for me is perspective. And the perspective that you get from seeing how other people live. And you suddenly realize that actually it's not just how your parents tell you the world works. It's like, oh my God, these guys live totally differently. Or these guys live totally differently again. So culture is this hugely broad subject. And we could probably have a 10-part series each digging into that. But what I'd love to spend some time on is the problem. So like you mentioned inflation already in the 70s. What were these guys trying to get around? Like what were the main problems that were the genesis of this movement?
I would say the overconsumption or rapid consumption. Like there's a big focus on shifting from consumption to production. And I think as Bitcoiners, it becomes quite obvious that, the fiat culture is a consumptive culture. That's literally how it's designed. I don't think these guys fully recognized it was the money, although they were dreaming up different monetary systems in permaculture as well, right? So it is very interesting, man. Wow. The parallels between permaculture and Bitcoin is just phenomenal, and I'm surprised that there's not more overlaps or people with the overlap. And so they're, designing and coming up with monetary systems and food systems and community systems. And the biggest problems are, and it's become obvious to me in recent years that it's this disconnection from the actual physical reality. And for me, it's so obvious now, knowing Bitcoin, that it's tied to the money. I kind of sensed that it was part of the problem. I didn't realize it was such a big core issue to the problem. I think probably deeper than that is the human affliction that allows that to proliferate. That's probably the only deeper problem that we have. But they're the kind of the problems they were looking at. So rapid consumption, chemicals in food, and destructive food systems, degenerative food systems, slapped together housing with cheap materials, like all of it, man. It's all started since then. And they were quick to see it early in the piece. And Bill Mollison in the 70s, he was already an elder, like he was already an old eccentric lecturer at a university talking about ecosystems and, that kind of network thinking, natural systems thinking. And then David was he's a student at the university, and they just like clicked together, got together like a house on fire. And then together they developed this idea of permaculture.
Really cool.
It is. And
one of the things that Bitcoin allows us to do is to actually just go deep down a bunch of rabbit holes that weren't in some ways previously accessible or even relevant. You know, why do you need to care where your food comes from? Because you just go to the supermarket. Like, you fucking moron. Why would I, like, and even even stuff like washing food, you know, why would you wash it? It's come from the shop.
Right.
You know, there's this sense that, like, everything is prepared for you and label is exactly as it should be and everything's totally safe and you're fine. Now, obviously, that's not necessarily the case given the myriad of different health problems that people clearly have. But Rupert, to now, what I love doing is learning from people's decision-making processes. So awesome subject area. Love to learn some more. But when I was doing a little research on what you shared with me and the projects you're building, this idea of shit hits the fan really caught my attention because it is very important. And I'll prefix this with the fact that I have a almost entirely digital wealth strategy now. That wasn't always the case. It was largely in UK equity and equally physical real estate. And I've shifted that over the last 5 years radically into Bitcoin. And you can't live in a Bitcoin. So I'm renting a house at the moment, and I've had a number of issues with renting over the last couple of years that audience members will have heard me complain about on previous episodes. But not owning your own shelter, being short shelter, has its own problems. Mm. But from a financial perspective, it's been a great decision because the purchasing power has rocketed since the major decision we made in 2022. And that's awesome. But it's like, you still need someone to be. Like, you have a physical meat body, and I have a young family with three kids and a wife, being like, where are we gonna live, mate? So when shit hits the fan, like, what am I gonna do? I don't know, right? Really, if shit hits the fan. So I'd love to understand how you came to asking yourself that question.
Look, that's a good question. And you know, it is largely tied to Bitcoin. And like, it's funny that you mentioned that you can't live in a Bitcoin. And what was his name? The politician, Jared Rennick, who was otherwise relatively sensible, you know, recently said you can't eat a Bitcoin. And, you know, he got roasted for that. As long as Bitcoin does what it's, you know, meant to do, that's great. You should always be able to buy some food and some housing. But if you bring it back to Ayn Rand's quote or comment, and I think it's out of Atlas Shrugged, which I have listened to, money is only as good as man's ability to produce the goods and services that you can buy with it. And so if people aren't producing the goods and services, your Bitcoin's not going to buy anything. And what actually got me to this place was there was something, I don't know what it was, but I could always just see there was something not right with the way our society was constructed, with the way culture was constructed. You know, there's a part of me, you know, we all have it in us. We all have like a built-in lie detector, right? It's it's kinesiological response that when someone's telling you a lie, you feel it, you sense it. But for this cultural lie that's so massive that everybody's going along with, it's a lot harder. But I could always feel it and I could always sense it. So I was like, okay, there's something not right about this. It's like a house of cards. This is pre-Bitcoin days, before I got it, before I got the money piece. Something is not right. What if it all collapses, what does it collapse to? Well, you have to be able to source food, water, shelter. Like, they're the basics. And now I don't have a direct relationship with any of those things. So how do I start to build a relationship with my food, with my water, with my shelter? And then beyond that, it's your actual community and the people around you, the relationships with the people around you, because you can't actually do it all by yourself. So then it's building a bunch of relationships with people that are into that sort of stuff as well. And so, yeah, it's really been this prepper focus, although I never really had that at the forefront of the messaging or the marketing, you might say, for grounded permaculture. It was always just about this like reconnection thing and the ancestral thing. But it was when we were here at this property, when we've been living here for 6 years, and the owner of the property, because we're renting as well, the owner of the property, but its values aligned renting, The owner of the property, he'd put a lot of time, energy, and money into this place and building community. But by the time we got here, he'd kind of given up on it and said, I'm just renting houses now and raising kids. And I said, that's fine. My model's based on renting. Let's do that and build a relationship. But after a few years, after COVID, he didn't like what happened with COVID. So he left the country and he came back and said, you know, actually, I want to sell. I want to exit. I'd rather get the capital and put it into Bitcoin, right? At the bottom of that bear market. But it's a tricky property to sell. He wasn't sort of driven to put it straight on the market and boot us all out. He liked what we were doing, gave us some time to come up with this model, to a company model to buy him out. And after the first incarnation of that, which we put together, was very feel good, very ideological, very, it was a little bit beyond its time even. And so what I did was, with after his feedback, he sort of said, look, Roops, I like what you're doing. If you change the messaging and the marketing to have more of a shit hits the fan focus, and I didn't even know what that meant at the time. I was like, what is this SHTF? And then I was like looking into it, and then I'm like, wow, there's a whole movement of preppers that are into this, that use this terminology. And he's kind of like that. And he was, this is what he kind of wants. This is what he treats this place like, and another property that he's got in the country. And so I sort of had to sit with it, and I was like, do I want to start to integrate this into my messaging? Because it can be a little bit fear-based, right? And I'm like, I don't want to be about propagating this fear. Like, the system's going to collapse. You better get ready. Mm-hmm. But actually, when I sat with it, that is my motivation. It is actually at my core motivation of prepping for when that system collapsed. And I didn't know what the system was, but it's quite obvious that it is the fiat monetary system that is going to collapse. And it is collapsing like a slow-moving train wreck in real time. And I don't know if it's even collapsed. It's like a hyperinflation, right? That's what it is. It's like an expansive collapse. So that's kind of the motivations and the decision-making behind it. So I was like, I've got to get to truth. I need to get to something where there's no middleman can get between me, where no one can like be, you know, stealing my efforts, right, of work as well. So when I put work into the earth, and if I do it in sync with the seasons and the cycles and nature, it works. I get exponential returns on my efforts. It's amazing. It's so amazing. So that's kind of the logic and the decision-making behind it. Yeah, to build something real and true and, yeah, in alignment with nature. Very and cool, reality and life.
I will give another kind of personal moment which hammers home why this is important. But my first year living in Australia full-time, having emigrated over from the UK, my wife's Aussie, we moved to Melbourne, which is where she grew up. And I was in St. Kilda. And the COVID lockdowns all happened. My first child was born July 2020. And over that 24-month period, we were effectively under house arrest.
Yeah,
because of our decision not to get involved in the medication that was then pushed, we were in a form of medical apartheid. It was an extraordinary experience in which none of the populace had any guns. So the police, like, they rode roughshod over everyone. And this isn't a podcast hammering home how horrible lockdown Melbourne was, but it was brutal. But I remember so clearly, it's like I owned a house, but I had this one situation where when I walked out of my front gate, the government owned the pavement. And on the end of my street, there was a school. And at the time, they had all of these rules about getting tests to go interstate travel, overseas travel. And there was a COVID testing center that was constructed in the car park of the school. And there was a queue of people the entire street waiting to get COVID tests. And they would stand right at my doorstep.
Whoa.
And you're like, what the fuck? This is a family neighborhood. Like, are these people sick? I don't know. But equally, get the fuck off my door. Like, what the fuck? And you'd go down and you'd talk to these morons that are pumping out these tests. And they're like, call the Department of Health. And you're like, oh my God. Well, that is going nowhere. But first of all, it's like, you have a piece of paper that says you have 195 square meters of land. But if they choose to put a testing clinic on your doorstep, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. Equally, where's the water coming from? Where's the food coming from? Like, I was forced to ask these truly fundamental questions that I've been able to not consider, given the way that the fiat system kind of does work. You know what I mean? It's like just good enough to keep you involved.
Yeah.
And that was obviously a big moment as well, where I'm like, I've owned Bitcoin for 5 years and suddenly companies are taking it on the balance sheet and I'm locked in my house and the relevance of it just like...
And
that was when the deep dive really began.
So you first got into Bitcoin 2015 and then the deep dive really with the COVID stuff triggered you to go to the bottom of the rabbit hole.
Well, it was mainly the money printing that happened. Oh my God, like they've just put 30% more dollars in the system. That's insane.
Yeah.
How, like, none of these other assets are keeping up. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so my allocation of my time went from a very small fraction focused on Bitcoin to being as much as possible. And my money slowly followed. So that great phrase of like, where your mind goes, your money follows.
For sure.
Same thing. The point of this, though, being like, what does it feel like to be closer to your food and to be closer to your water and to own the output of your production? Because I've felt the pain of not being in that position quite severely in the last couple of years. And like, paint a picture for me. Like, why would I want to go and experience this?
Bro, I can't even begin to describe. It's like the most enlivening, empowering experience that's written about in the oldest stories of Christian culture, like the Garden of Eden. Like we're in the garden and it's all there and everything you want and you don't have to do any work. That's kind of what trying to create, right? I'm trying to, like, you still got to put work in, you got to set things up, but the idea is to try and set things up that look after themselves, that require very minimal input and work from your end. And the more you can hack that, or nature hack that, the better off you are. And it's been a lifeline for me, man, because without it, that pain that you're talking about, I felt that too. And I just I couldn't do it. It was just so painful. I guess it just drove me to figure out how to set up these abundant food systems to get closer to my food and know, like, reduce the food miles, the food Ks, right? And it's so good. It's the most joyful, happy, satisfying feeling I could ever imagine. So I do it.
And so, Rupert, if you could paint me a picture then, like, what do you do in a day? Like, if you choose to live in this manner, like, what does a day of work look like? Or a day of rest look like? Or how do you spend your time?
Good question. I guess my situation is kind of unique because I've created, you know, I set up this not-for-profit and I've created all these activities around it.
And the not-for-profit is the Grounded Permaculture.
Action Party, yeah. And we did, you know, $470,000 in revenue last financial year. I think this year is going to be a little bit less. But most of that revenue is through this hub where we have the commercial lease on the property. And so we all pay rent to live here. We also run events and some camping activities here. And other people come and use our creek flat. So there's all this activity here. We don't actually sell any produce. We just grow a lot for ourselves and we feed the events. And when we do consults or installs for other people, we source all the food and propagation material from here. We do a lot of tree planting in the valley as well. So I've scored a lot of like corporate contract bush regen work. So that, you know, gives myself and half a dozen steady wage, you might say, as well. And you know, a typical day, man, is anything from, you know, changing compost toilets to sitting down with Grok and crafting out my latest marketing material or something, you know. So it's very varied. Listening to Bitcoin podcasts and books and things. So, yeah, but I think for most people, you know, it doesn't take as much work as one might think. There's definitely work to put in at the start to sort of get yourself across the knowledge. It's similar to Bitcoin in a lot of ways. Once you sort of putting that those hard yards up front and you grasp the basics, then you can kind of ride that momentum, because the way that it's structured, it feeds back to you in a positive way, and there aren't people in between stealing from you, or you're not trying to do it in a way that's not in line with the harmony and nature of everything. So yeah, it can be as little as 10 minutes a day, but pretty much for me, it's all day, every day. I'm working with plants, I'm working on the land. And if I'm not doing that, I'm on the computer sharing that message about what we're doing and living a more holistic, and I would say it's like holistic wealth in all aspects and all dimensions of life.
No, it sounds awesome, Rupert. And particularly what I like is listening to people who have found something that they love doing.
Yeah.
Because it just, I can feel it straight away. Like, you can't talk about like smelling bullshit.
Yeah.
You can smell the opposite, which is like, yeah, great vibe. This is something you obviously really love doing. And that's what's so fun about podcasting in a way is getting people's stories and understanding like, how on earth did you end up doing that? And what I'd like to understand now more of is, because as an investor, I'm always looking at investment opportunities. So I understand you can actually put capital into this. How does that work, and why would people do it, or why have people done it thus far?
Okay, that's a good question. So it's a little bit different as well, our model. When it comes to, this idea of investing in community, a lot of people want to get, they put their X amount of dollars in, 100K, 200K, whatever it is, and they want their plot. They want, that's my piece of land. There's lots and lots of models around that. In fact, so many, that's the kind of been the standard go-to model for community through an MO or, body corporate models and things like that. You put your money in, you got a plot. And the model that I've developed, and it was even before the company structure to raise the money to buy this place, this idea of a regenerative living hub is based on a rental model. And I think the rental model is more powerful, because even if you own a place, and you said you owned a house, you're still effectively paying rent, because you've got to pay land taxes, council rates, you got to pay for building maintenance and improvements just to stop it going backwards and ship breaks, all of that, right? Mm. You're still paying. You're still paying to keep that thing going. So the rental model sort of takes all that pressure off in a way, and it also allows for, well, not even take that pressure off. It just like quantifies it and just goes, right, this is what it costs to live.
That's precisely why I like renting, Rupert.
Yeah, because you don't have all
that. Physical infrastructure is not my problem.
Yeah, great.
If some of it breaks, deal with it.
Fully.
Not my problem. Yeah.
Fully. And the other thing that I like about our model, before we dive into the mechanics of how it works on this high level, is that it allows for the flexibility for individuals that do live at these hubs and spaces to have different living spaces and setups based on how their conditions of life change over time. So I've lived here at this property for 6 years. 2019, I came with a bunch of friends and we started the share house. That was one of the houses on the property. 2020, my partner moved here when COVID happened, and very soon after she got pregnant. And so then by the end of 2020, we were like, I was saying
shit hit the fan, but you're like, come on, babe, let's go.
Well, here's the thing, man. COVID happened and everyone's freaking out. Oh, shit, we need to get out of the city. We need to get on land. We need to grow some food and build community. I'm like, I got that suss. I got that right here, guys. So now how do I help people? And then that began my deep dive into money, business, and marketing, really, since then. And obviously still doing more permaculture, like growing more food and helping more people grow food. But like in terms of my own learnings. And so 2020, then, she got pregnant and I said to the landlord, look, I'm looking for a family home. I can't stay in the share house doing this. And he's like, well, I don't like what's happening with COVID and the government response. Why don't you rent my house on the property that he was living in? And I'll pay you to be my agent and manage the property. And I was like, well, that's in the direction I wanted to go since I got here. So yeah, let's do that. And so then I had the whole house. We had this whole house, classic thing, the family, young kid. That unfortunately didn't go that well. We separated. after 2 years of that setup. And then she moved to a little off-grid cabin on the property, right? So we kind of got to have our own space. We got moved down here into the studio. We got to have our own space, but still be close. And so it allows for people as life, you know, you got kids, you need to expand. You kids go, you can contract. It allows for that flexibility over time. So that's the beauty of the rental thing. Whereas if you buy a plot, you're kind of locked in for a long time on that plot. Okay, so how does it work? Why would people want to do it? The idea is we've got a company structure set up separate to Grounded as a not-for-profit. And you basically were selling equity in that company, and it would be a company title on the land. And then the company would then lease the land out to a suitable party to operate and manage the site. In this case, for this property, I would say Grounded is the most suitable because we've been doing it for a number of years and we've got it all, the proof of concept set up. But technically, it doesn't have to be Grounded. So I imagine the scenario, we have a group of investors, everyone's put in their 100K. We've purchased this site, Grounded leases it out. The company gets the returns from that lease. And as part of that deal, Grounded, like a farm lease or a factory lease, takes care of all of the things on the property. So we do all the minor building maintenance. We do driveways. We do lawns. We do gardens. We do all the things, right? Cover most of the cost. When it comes to capital works, we sort of try and negotiate a deal with the landlord. And so he's getting a return. But from an investment perspective, you and I both know, and the Bitcoin is proving to the world that it is the best store of value and the best investment if you're just looking to invest and get maximum returns. But like you said, you can't live in a Bitcoin. And so some people want a peace of mind knowing that they've got a stake in a site that's not just a piece of land that's sitting there and atrophying or not doing anything while they're not there, but is actively being looked after and is becoming more abundant over time and is becoming stronger and more resilient over time. And they may or may not want to live there. If they do want to live there, then they sort of essentially rent like everybody else. That's sort of separating that investor-resident relationship, even though one could play both roles. Then there's all these other lifestyle benefits that come with it, which is having some storage on site, which is the current landlord has, knowing that they can come here when shit hits the fan or, you know, if something personal is going on in your life, coming and camping here. There's also the most crazy out there thing aspect of the whole plan, which is not that crazy considering what we've been doing for the last 10 years, is let's say a really bad something happens, whether it's a man-made or natural disaster. And, you know, everyone in the company's like, hey, this is pretty bad. Shit's hitting the fan. So we would call a company meeting. We would say, should we execute the protocol? We say, get 2/3 of the vote and say yes. So then what we do is allow all of the investors to come and set up camp here on the Creek Flat, which, you know, is quite a large space. So I imagine 40 investors with a partner, maybe kids. So it could be up to 100 people. They come and camp up to 3 months. We basically, all the food on site becomes available for everyone who's here. We also have a dry bulk food store that's used to sort of supplement that. Now, that seems like a bit crazy of like, how are you going to manage 100 people, you know, in that kind of situation? But then that's what we've been doing for the last 10 years is running these events 2-3 weeks at a time where we are kind of in that space of just like simple, low-key living, everybody sharing food, eating from the land. And so, yeah, that's kind of like the craziest part of it, but it's actually not that crazy because that's what we've been doing anyway in a temporary sense. And that's how I see it. So that's one aspect of the investment. So it's kind of like for people that are, they just want something tangible, real, but not just a piece of land that's doing nothing. It's like actively and professionally managed in a regenerative sense. You get some returns out of it. There is obviously the capital appreciation, although that's so hard to measure these days because we're measuring still in fiat, you know, I don't know about you, like trying to measure.
You haven't sold the property or anything like that, or the company, so there's an illiquidity as well to the value.
Yeah, there's that too. But I think also coming back to that statement of like you can't live in a Bitcoin, what I'm trying to create is a situation where if this works, and it, you know, if it works exactly the way I imagine, we raise the money to buy this place, shareholders, and part of the structure as well, which the current owner gave me feedback on and which we integrated, was that, say, 20% of the capital is held as liquid assets, which would include Bitcoin. And then that also helps generate more returns. But also, if any investor wants to exit really quickly and we don't have another buyer, we have a pool of capital to pay them out. So that's allowing for people's own personal situations if shit hits the fan in a personal sense and they need to exit quickly. So there's that. But the idea is that the company would never have to sell the land if it's done right. The company, if shareholders want to leave, they would just sell their shares. If and it shouldn't ever need to sell a site because it's leased out to entities that manage the site professionally and generate returns for the holder. So, yeah, I think that's, I hope that summed up a bit of the essence of it.
Yeah, that's cool. The way I'm kind of thinking it through is, it's, let's say the investment was a ticket size of 100 grand.
Yeah.
Depending on what percentage of your net wealth that is, of course, like for each person, that represents a different amount of money.
Yeah.
But the, in essence, it's an option on Shelter.
Yep.
So you're like, this is an option that I could exercise in a shit hits the fan moment.
Yep.
And I mean, interestingly, I've been living in Byron the last year or so, and I just popped in Google Maps. I think you're not far from here at all, like an hour and a half max.
Yep.
And it's like, that's actually totally doable if something did go wrong. Now, one of the reasons for being in Byron in the first place is I'm not in a major city.
Yep.
So like, it's a pretty sleepy little town that, you know, is not going to be the first thing that gets nuked or the first place that gets locked down. If some kind of, you know, who knows what drama is going to happen in the future. But I like this as a, if you're looking for pure financial returns, it's not going to be Bitcoin. But what it could be is a diversification into an area that Bitcoin just doesn't do, which is shelter. And that, to me, and makes a ton of sense. And food, yes. And, it's like a double combo. And the details around, like, oh my God, if every investor rocked up at the same time and required the food at the same time, like, that's just a problem you'd have to deal with at the time.
Yeah.
You know, this is an entrepreneurial thing, 100%. You're doing something new, so you just figure it out.
Yeah.
But the whole point of being there, in my mind, is that it's going to be safer than where they've come from.
Sure.
So, you know what I mean? And like, the local Coles might have nothing in it. You just don't know.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, so there's that one aspect, and I tweaked all this based on the current owner's feedback. And he's like, this is what I want. And I'm like, this is what you already have. But he's the sole owner, right? And he kind of was like, well, I don't need to be the sole owner. I can share it. And if I'm in Mexico or Austria and shit goes down, I can't get there, then no one can really leverage it. So like you said, it comes down to the percentage of the net worth, and it's an option. And for people that have got other things going on, it's good to know that, hey, there's a piece of land there. There's a solid crew taking care of it. Things are getting better over time. It's like, it's a working site. It's not atrophying. It's regenerating. And I can go there. And I think the other adding to that of, like, if everyone rocked up at the same time and shit really hit the fan, to add to that, which I'm kind of excited about, is to practice for that. It's kind of like a fire drill. And so part of the idea is, once we've raised this and set it all up, the only things that I have to do or change is to start running this shit hits the fan boot camp, is what I'm going to call it. So it would happen once a year. It would be primarily for investors, and we might just do it over a week or a long weekend. And it's just running the scenario. Yeah, cool. Rock up. You can't bring food. You can't bring water. You can't bring fuel. That we can't even get that ourselves. We've just got to work with whatever we've got. And there's no communications. So, like, once we're here, and we just sort of run that scenario, gets everybody to meet each other. We sort of, you know, get to trial those systems, and then just do it once a year, like a fire drill. And I run events all the time. So I just treat it as an event. I could also use it to get interested investors to come along, you know, who are maybe on the wait list and just stuff like that. So I think it's totally possible. The other thing is, that's kind of like a passive investor. An active investor might be someone that's like, hey, actually, I want to get more involved. I actually want to come and live on site. I've got all these skills I can contribute. and they might come and, you know, rent a space, and, you know, we can start stacking enterprises because we run events here. That's one aspect that people get involved with. You know, there's opportunities to, in the long-term vision, to bring a tiny house or a cabin, and, you know, an investor might bring their own structure here, and then we rent it out on Airbnb and split the cash, which we already do for a caravan on the property. Or they might, we just rent it off them on a long-term basis and put a tenant in there. And so there's like ways to sort of stack all these things. And then the other thing that I see is once we've secured this site, the idea would be to then leverage the equity and the cash flow to secure the next one, to buy the next site. Because for me, I like to dream things up, pull it together and execute and make it happen. So I love doing events. Once it's just kind of the same thing over and over again, I kind of get a bit bored. And I want to be able to hand this site on to the crew and team, look after, and then I find the next site. And then I set it up and I find the potential and I start, you know, getting the economic engine for it, driving and happening, bring people there, get a crew in, set it up, run it. Brisket and I talk about, I see the next one maybe being on the sunny coast. It spreads like a mycelium network. And it's all held under the company, right? So this company would be like an asset holding company for its shareholders, focused on regenerative assets, primarily, you know, rural land, productive rural land. Talk about getting a beef property up on the sunny coast, right? And then awesome. We've got beef secured. Like this, just like securing the sites, making them productive, providing livelihood for residents and tenants that live there, and also, you know, delivering returns for investors.
And so, Rupert, it's, you know, you hear the word citadel banded around the Bitcoin space, and it's at times it's a bit of a nothing burger for me. It's like, who's actually doing this? And what you're telling me today is an actual example, and it's brilliant. And you're right. Like, once you've developed the initial prototype, like any route to market for any product or any service, it's like, okay, well, we've done one and here's how it works. And here's how we're going to do the second one.
Yeah.
It's a much easier story to sell.
Yeah.
It strikes me actually, just as I think this through, I'm starting to see more physical real estate deals that are leveraging Bitcoin in a way that is brand new. But a simple example being a company making a real estate purchase. Let's say it's $1 million property. Yep. They might have been able to have a solid relationship with a lender that they've done a bunch of other deals with before. And they paid $200,000, 20% deposit, and they get an $800,000 loan. So 80% loan to value ratio. Now, I've started to see deals where people are actually taking on more debt at the same fixed duration and same fixed terms. So whether they got a 10% interest rate fixed for 5 years or 25 years, it depends on the nature of the deal. Mm. But they go and take an extra 20% loan and are buying Bitcoin. And in the terms of the loan, they're saying you have to hold this Bitcoin for a minimum of 4 years. But it's another way of basically eating the fiat system at the same time as benefiting yourself.
Mm.
I.e., you can get dollars fixed for a period of time at a number that you know Bitcoin's going to outpace. Mm. And you use a physical real world asset to secure the loan, like a piece of land.
Mm.
So I would 100% be banging the drum of this holding company that you're describing. The investor puts in then $100,000, but maybe try and get 120 off them. And you put the extra 20 straight into Bitcoin.
Well,
and
I mean,
like, this is an additional piece of the balance sheet that's not going to ever be invested in the land itself.
Yeah.
But will help to finance the future of the company itself.
Absolutely.
And
we're pretty much already doing that. So the idea, cool, based on coming back from the owner, because originally I was like, oh, well, you want $3 million, we'll get 30 shares at $100,000 each. There's your $3 million. And he's come back to me going, look, Rupes, I like what you're doing, but I didn't jump on board with your company structure. If we raised $4 million and purchased the place for $3 million, then we've got $1 million or take out stamp duty, say $800,000. Of liquid capital that we can invest into Bitcoin. And, you know, maybe we would, depending on who the shareholders are, maybe we need to have a few other things in that mix. But exactly that, to shore up the financial performance of the company, And also have that pool of liquidity to pay out investors if they need to exit really quickly. And I will say, like, I've been accepting some, because the first step, if someone's interested after they've watched the pitch, is $1,000 initial deposit, 90% refundable at any stage. So that basically is just a foot in the door saying, hey, I like this. I'm keen. I want to see the financials. I want to see the business plan. I want to see the company constitution, the share purchase agreement, all the legal docs. So that $1,000 goes in. Some people have put that in as Bitcoin to as a hold, like as their deposit to hold in Bitcoin. And some people have put their $1,000 in and I've just gone and bought Bitcoin with it. Not all of it, but I'm buying Bitcoin. So I've set up the, cool, you know, the exchange under the company account, and I've got a, you know, cold storage solution for the company. So it's only small, but I'm already doing it for the company.
Well done. Interesting. Because it's just so new, right? Like incorporating Bitcoin on the balance sheet is not something that many people have ever done before. And there's obviously, you know, the Bitcoin treasury playbook that has been pioneered by MicroStrategy is now becoming, you know, the sweetheart of Wall Street. And we're seeing capital raises in the billions daily being announced of these new vehicles that are kind of hitting fiat stock markets around the world.
It's crazy.
And to some degree, it's brilliant because it's just banging the drum for Bitcoin. But it's how do we actually make that useful for the individual? And much to your point earlier about Galt's Gulch, but like being closer to the means of production and not losing out to the scammers and the virus and the bureaucracy in the middle, this is similar, right? Because the way that a regulated public company is going to have to function, there's going to be a load of people that are going to have their big fat fingers in those pies on the way through. Whereas here, it's actually very different. It's a much, much smaller scale, but private with real company output, right?
Yeah, private company with maximum 50 shareholders.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. And as I think back to what I just said about instead of asking for 100, ask for 120K, I actually don't know if that's the right call, because the flip side of that is actually people are better off having their own assets in as much of their own control as possible.
Yep.
And in my mind, at least, if they've got spare capital, just buy Bitcoin themselves.
Yeah.
But the company, when looking to leverage and using the land as the asset, might be able to get extra debt. And that's where you want to be taking on the extra dollars, not necessarily in equity from people, because then they're losing out on owning more Bitcoin.
Yep.
But Rupert, one thing here that you've obviously will have spent a long time thinking about through all this is, anyone that's looked at a Bitcoin chart versus the average real estate price of each, you know, housing market, let's say the average house price in Sydney or the average house price in Melbourne, anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
5 years ago, it cost you a lot of Bitcoin. Now it costs you like a handful of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
10 years ago, it cost like, you know, a lot of Bitcoin, and it's getting slowly smaller and smaller. So as Bitcoin grows in purchasing power, if you understand the beauty of that, why would you own anything else? And so you have to be able to answer that very effectively. Now, shelter is key, right? It's a very, very important thing to be thinking about buying instead of owning Bitcoin. But real estate is getting absolutely mullered by Bitcoin as a store of value.
Yep.
So how do you play those two things off?
Well,
and this is something I struggle with every day. I mean, I could go and buy a family home tomorrow, but it's like,
bro,
that's a lot of Bitcoin in 5 years' time, which, you know, that really might be life-changing. And it's like, at what point are you being an ignorant pig and you just need to buy a house, or are you being greedy? I don't know. There's a middle ground somewhere, I'm sure.
Well, look, I wrestle with that a fair bit myself. So we're in a unique situation where I get it. The owner of this property gets it. And then there's 8 investors in total on board at the moment. So we've got probably half of them get Bitcoin, the other half don't, but they know that I'm a Bitcoiner, right? And they're
Cool. I think that's good, because there's then an additional market of people that you can sell the product to. Like, you don't want to just be selling to Bitcoiners.
But I think, like you said before, man, it's like, if you just want the maximum return, then just hold the Bitcoin. It's a really tricky one, man. And this is where it's like, you know, Jeff Booth comes to mind, and just trying to bend the brain into understanding, even as a Bitcoiner, I'm still very much measuring. I'm an engineer as well. I'm still measuring so much in fiat. Like everything is still measured in fiat. And so we don't actually know. This is the insight that I've got in the last, say, week or so. We don't actually know the true price of anything right now. We don't know the true price of anything because when we measure in Bitcoin, prices are free falling. When we measure in fiat, they're going exponential. So we don't know where it's going to land. We don't know how, you know, like as Jeff Booth says, prices fall to the marginal cost of production. So we don't truly know what that marginal cost of production is because everything's so distorted. So, you know, it is an interesting one. Like, it's funny because the, you know, the owner of the property gets it and he knows that the longer this takes, the less Bitcoin he's going to be able to buy. Right. And so it's like, oh, wow, if we price the property in Bitcoin, okay, so it's like 20 Bitcoin today. It might be 10 Bitcoin in a few years or even 5 or even 4, 3, 2, 1 Bitcoin. I'm like, could I offer him 1 Bitcoin now? Like, probably not. But so it's like, yeah, it's this. We're sort of in this transition. We have both things as the measuring stick. And to reconcile that, I'm just like, look, if you want the returns, just do Bitcoin. If you want to actually plug in to something on the land with people, know that even if you're not living here, there's a crew here. You can come here. There's food here. When you are ready to get on land, you're not starting from scratch. You know, there's all of those aspects. So that's kind of how I reconcile it. And then just also being a Bitcoiner, knowing how important it is to have it on the balance sheet, and then knowing all of these kind of little being open or knowing the options and the ways that it can be leveraged, like you said, of even some of that Bitcoin could be used as collateral to get a loan to help fund the next place. It doesn't have to just be the equity from the place that we, the physical land that we own. So yeah, there's just so many possibilities, but we're always going to need land, like you said, to live on and to produce food. And that's kind of where I just focus at, which is really the utility value. And I don't know if we will know the true price of that in the next few years. It'll probably take all out of the fiat system to know the true price.
We'll be a lot older when it has flipped. That's for sure. It's gonna be a slow burn. Like, it's like we touched on the very start. In some ways, it feels like it's happening incredibly fast. And in other ways, it's like this is a slow-moving train wreck in real time.
Yeah.
One thing that's come to mind, Rupert, is this morning a friend of mine told me, he said, oh, my friend's Iranian and they just had their mum here in Australia and they've traveled back to Iran and they are in a town in Iran where the communications have been knocked out and they don't know if their mum's still alive because it's being bombed. And of course, East Coast Australia, very, very different place to be. But like, you just don't know when shit is going to hit the fan. You have no idea. So my heart goes out to that woman and anyone who's involved in the shenanigans that's happening there. Some of these videos of missile strikes that I've seen, are they real? Like, you just don't know, right? So try and judge it with a pinch of salt in a sense. But the day you need this product, it's too late.
Yeah,
I think is what I'm sitting here thinking. It's like, you need to probably think about this now in case something did go wrong to the extent that it could. Some of the investors or customers that you've had come to you thus far, are they thinking that, you mentioned this already, like that doomsday scenario? What drives them to sign up with this?
Yeah, most people recognize, even the ones that aren't Bitcoiners, that the system, mainstream system, is fragile. You know, they might not even use the word fiat. It's fragile. It's on a house of cards. It can't keep going on the way it's going. They realize there's this importance of getting back to those base level needs and having a direct connection with that food, water, shelter, and community, which, you know, I see that as the actual base layer of reality, right? And we talk about Bitcoin being the base layer of civilization or society, which is true because money is kind of essentially that base layer of directing action and trade. But below that is actually the relational field. It's the tribal ancestral field that we lived in for a very, very long time, and 99% of our ancestors have lived in before money came along. And that's actually the base layer of reality. It's personal relationships, and it's you know, the food, water, shelter, the physicality of life.
Connection to nature, yeah.
Yeah, it's the physicality, right? Because that's actually how all of it works. So, yeah, they see that and they're driven for that. Not, I think ultimately everyone sees themselves at some point living here or somewhere like here. Maybe not right now, maybe not in the next few years, but this, you know, it's part of everyone's dream and dreaming.
When you're trying to understand why something exists, it's like, why does someone buy it? It's essentially what I was trying to get to. One thing that you mentioned has intrigued me, which is this idea of expanding to a second location. You and Brisket had spoken about a beef project somewhere.
Yep.
The model that you're describing, it's actually... like it is quite scalable in that sense, isn't it? And I think that it's a much easier sell to any potential future investor of another project, like a single investor to go and not buy Bitcoin and buy a massive beef farm. Like that opportunity cost is, that's a big trade for an individual. Now, it depends, of course, what their net wealth is. If they're ludicrously wealthy and a beef farm is actually like 1%, then maybe for them that's an option on food supply. You just don't know what someone's bringing to the table. But by being able to like have much smaller shareholdings, it means people can keep more Bitcoin, which is obviously the financial security, but then you're able to finance the purchase of a productive asset, which is, I actually think that's fascinating, because it's not like we talked about, do you buy a house or do you wait? You have to do it at some point. And therefore, if you can kind of de-risk it in some ways, that's actually really smart.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I think that's the key difference here. And it's so different to what so many other communities, when they go and get themselves set up. The focus of this is the company is an asset holding company that holds and manages these assets and generates returns for the investors. Those assets are productive assets. It's not just like, just, you know, there is a focus on the economic aspect, but then it also, what it does is it, by allowing entities to lease each site, there's a level of autonomy for the operators and for the residents and the people that live there, that they can just kind of run with it and look after it. And then as they put that work in and they're making lots of money on it, they're getting that extra. The company's got its set income, you know, taken care of, because it's holding those things and it's got cash flow coming in from the leases. But then those who are there on the ground, putting in the work, making it work, you know, it's stacked so that they can benefit from that as well. So I think there's so many layers and benefits to it. And I just trust that it will all come together in the right time, like all of my ideas have. And I think for this one, it's going to take, you know, kind of like COVID. There was a big surge of people looking for land, and a lot of communities got off the ground and people just throwing cash at projects. And at that point, we didn't have anything. We just got here. The landlord didn't want to sell. We were just kind of like, you know, we're cool. And then, yeah, after that wave, the market bottomed out. He's like, okay, I think I actually want to sell this and buy some Bitcoin. But yeah, we kind of missed that mad rush where everyone was trying to get out of the city and get on land and grow community. And I have every faith. I have every
every faith
assurance, every faith. I just know that it's going to happen. I know that it's going to happen again.
Mate,
that's
will.
Right.
And I think something that gives me, what's the right way of saying this? Peace of mind, perhaps, is a way of phrasing it. Australia's fucking massive.
Yep.
And so it's a continent the size of the United States with 25 million people living on the very, very outskirts of it in basically three cities.
Yep.
So within a 10-hour drive from anyone's house, no one's going to come and find you.
No.
So to me, that's the default defensive position of like basically remoteness. And what you've explained to me today sounds like a brilliant pathway to doing that. You know, it's all very well getting in the car for 10 hours, but turning up somewhere where you haven't got any connections, you don't have anywhere to go, you have no idea where the food is, you don't know what water you can drink. Like, that's also not hey, babe, come this way.
Yeah.
Not the best plan, mate.
Yeah.
Well, Rupert, it's been awesome to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for sharing everything. If people want to reach out and get in touch, what's the best way to do that?
Well, there is the Grounded Permaculture website and socials. Grounded Permaculture is probably the most active thing. It's kind of got the biggest reach and produces the most content and events and things. I've also got my own personal page, which I've launched, you know, softly in the last year, and podcast The Natural Capitalist. Otherwise, I've also got music online under the pseudonym Brother Beans.
Cool. I'll link those in the show notes as well. Well, Rupert, thanks so much for your time today.
All right. Thanks. Have a good night.